Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday Take. It is February 1st, 2026. I'm your host, Blois Olson. Well, we got through January. I just want to give us all a little feeling of, whoa, I told you to pace yourself in 2026. I had no idea that that's where we're going to go. But take a deep breath, because February, the first week of February, starts out with a lot of action, and we must reflect about the week behind and think about the week ahead. First, the week ahead will have precinct caucuses, and those will happen on Tuesday. If you're not familiar, Minnesota is a caucus state, and so we will look ahead to the straw poll on the Republican side in the governor's race. Obviously, last week, a little news in that governor's race with Chris Maddow dropping out of the race. It was a surprise, but I think it was a principled decision based on the current state of the Republican Party, what his personal feelings were, and that he couldn't fake it. He could not fake it as a candidate for governor going forward. I think there'll be some maneuvering and some shifting after Tuesday's straw poll. Expect Lisa Daymuth to do well. Expect Kendall Qualls to do well. Then I think watch and see what Mike Lindell does. Watch and see what Kristen Robbins does. And I think as you look at those candidates, you'll start to see the race take shape. Of course, 2022 nominee Scott Jensen also will be on the straw poll ballot. He has said he will not abide by the endorsement. He has not had a particularly strong showing in previous straw polls. But the real question is, how long do they stick around? And does that Republican field consolidate? There's also buzz because Amy Klobuchar announced she's running for governor. And then on Friday emerged a draft Aaron May Quaid effort for governor. And this is what I've talked about the last few weeks, that how is this going to shape up if we have a contested DFL primary? There is no doubt that are DFL activists who are not satisfied with Amy Klobuchar. The difference is, will they really push back, or will they understand that their best chance of winning in November is probably with Amy Klobuchar, and that creating a bunch of noise now with another candidate is not likely to work? And then a month from now, it has been confirmed that on March 4th, Governor Walz and Attorney General Ellison will testify in front of Congress. You remember last time Governor Walz did this, it cost taxpayers $400,000 in preparation fees. We'll watch to see that number. How much do each of them spend to testify? Do they need to spend a lot? And just the buildup there. It's been very clear that despite Tom Homan coming to town last week, despite some movement in some other places, that we have not seen Governor Walz, nor have we seen Mayor Fry tone down the rhetoric. And the pushback against the feds is still going. We expect some federal officers to leave this week and I think try to get, quote, back to normal. But one of the places that normal may never come again is the Minnesota State Legislature. And this week, we had more retirements. We had Gary Dames, and we had Representative Paul Torkelson. Representative Torkelson, first elected in 2008. He's currently the co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee in the House. He's a veteran. He's measured. He is thoughtful. He's everything you'd want in a legislator as far as engaging and ready to converse about the issues. And so he's just the latest in loss of institutional knowledge. It's over 300 plus years of knowledge lost in legislative retirements, and we expect up to 30 in total. You can always check out our Fluence Election Tracker at FluenceElectionTracker.com. But when we come back, Representative Paul Torkelson. Representative Torkelson is going to talk about his time there, how the legislature's changed, and if Republicans have put too many eggs in the Trump basket. I'm Blois Olson. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO. Join
lemonade! Fresh squeeze lemonade! Lemonade? Oh, nuts.
Is your business struggling to be seen? Not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, mine starts here.
Joining me now is Representative Paul Torkelson. He is a veteran of the legislature. He's in House Republican leadership. He and I have had plenty of times over the years, usually out in greater Minnesota near his district, that we have had conversations about agriculture, about the economy, and about politics. And I view him as a workhorse, one of those members of the legislature who really dug in and got the work done. And he announced this past week that he's not going to seek re-election. So I thought we'd reflect on that conversation this morning. Representative Torkelson, first of all, thanks for your service and thanks for joining me on Sunday Tech.
You bet. And thanks for the invite, boys. It's nice to join you. Pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Just give me a kind of a reflection. Obviously, probably a pretty big decision, one you didn't take lightly. When did you start thinking about not serving after this term? And is there any other kind of dynamics out there than just having been there since 2009?
Well, when I first ran, I sat down with my wife and we had a long discussion about whether I should run or not. And I said, well, honey, I want to serve at least 10 years. And she thought I said I would serve only 10 years. So the discussion started about 8 years ago.
Well, there you go. So so you got more years out than you had originally thought about. What talk about from 2009? That was a year that obviously President Obama was elected in your first year, 2008. It was a Democratic surge. We saw another one of those in 2022. Was there differences between those two eras? Is there anything you really have seen change so much that the legislature is starkly different than when you started?
Well, when I came in 2009, of course, I was very wet behind the ears, just glad to have gotten elected. But we only had 47 members in our caucus. Pawlenty was governor, though, so we had some power with the governor's office, and we were able to uphold his vetoes. That's about the only thing we could really do effectively, but we did that. Then, of course, we recovered and in numbers and had some majorities along the way. Lots of things have changed with the legislature, of course. It's a different place. I still think we have a bit of a COVID hangover. You know, members that came in during COVID didn't get the normal experience of starting to serve in the legislature and develop some habits that I think have really negatively affected the way we communicate and the way we function at the legislature. It's different. And then you pile on some of these other events that have happened more recently. It's a kind of a uneasy feeling right now, but that's certainly not why I'm retiring. I'm getting kind of long in the tooth, and it's time to move on to other things.
You're still farming. You're still active in that way. What is the reason? Is it just to give somebody else a chance? Is it the energy it takes, the hours, the campaign? What finally made you decide not to run again?
Well, you know, when you go to the grocery store and pick up an item, it's got a best buy date on it. And so I don't want to exceed my best buy date. I don't want to still be in the legislature when people are saying, how come that guy hasn't retired by now? You know, I don't want to be there. I want to go out serving to my full capacity, and I hope I am. I'm looking forward to this year. I've got a lot of work to do as Ways and Means co-chair, and I intend to go out strong.
Let's go back to the COVID hangover. There's been just so much turnover in the legislature, probably since 2018. You know, two-thirds of the legislature or so is new. There's a lot of institutional change as well. Institutional knowledge leaving. We've written a memo that people have really latched on to. You're the Ways and Means co-chair. What are the things you want to make sure get passed on from your experience to other legislators who may have that role in the future?
Well, you know, communication is such a critical piece of the work we do. During COVID, of course, communication was cut off. There were no hallway conversations. There were no conversations before and after committee meetings. And so we kind of lost that habit among many of our members. I think communication, not only across aisle, but within your own caucus is so important. And we kind of got out of the habit. I think we're working our way back toward that. At least I feel that way. But there's room for progress. And I just hope that the people that serve starting next year really come in with eyes and ears wide open.
You were there in your first couple of terms when budgets were tighter. Budgets are getting tighter again. We've obviously had some increase in spending since you've been there. What is the knowledge, or what do you think the culture or the newer members will learn under a tighter budget rather than these years of surplus?
Well, it's government has gotten a lot more expensive, and much of it is driven by the social programs that we fund. And it's also driven in part just by the aging population, of course. People expect more from government, it seems. And once we've started these programs, they take on a life of their own, and they just don't go away. The fraud thing, I hope, is a temporary thing, but this size and growth of government is kind of a trend that it's really hard to buck, but it's very expensive, and it's forcing us to put taxpayers in a situation where at least some people I know are thinking, you know, maybe I don't really need to live in Minnesota anymore.
We hear about that anecdotally. And the numbers bear out that we have had more migration out of the state. What is that like in greater Minnesota? How do those conversations go when you're at the grocery store, when you're at church, when you're in your community? What's the mood of greater Minnesota with regard to fiscal discipline at the state and livability in the state?
Well, it depends on your tax bracket to a big degree, honestly. People right now are saying, you know, if they're going to waste my tax dollars, why should I send them in? But they will, and they do. And for those of us in the ag committee, in the ag community, you know, we're kind of locked in. You can't move a farm to across a border. So,
right.
So we're here to stay, and we just need to, I think, as the government needs to take more consideration over the burden it's putting on its citizens.
As you think about agriculture, obviously, I always say, and I think this is one of those conversations I always ask when we're at Farm Fest, is, so what's the mood? What are people feeling? Obviously, ag has had a lot of volatility and a lot of challenges. Minnesota is an ag state leader. What do you think the state needs to do to remain a leader? And are there things the state can do on policy that would be, you know, helpful for the ag community right now?
Well, ag is in transition too. We have a lot of older farmers, including myself, that need to transition out. I think there are things we do, and that we should do more of to make those transitions easier. So it's easier, for instance, to pass on an operation to the next generation. Those are tax policies and also young farmer policies that we do some work there, but I think we could do a lot more.
Is ag one of the areas that is still bipartisan? Is there still good conversation, good relationship over ag policy with the Walz administration?
Yes, I think so. The Commissioner of Ag, of course, has got a great reputation. He's a good guy. He works hard and communicates well with all of us. Of course, we do have the ag community has its differences too. I grew up a Farm Bureau guy. I was very active in Minnesota Farm Bureau for many years. When I was first elected to office, I also took out a membership in Farmers Union. I think my father, who was in his grave, probably rolled over a time or two, but because those differences were much more stark years ago. But there still are differences in the approach to agriculture and what agriculture means, especially for family farms. And but in general, the ag community is pulling together.
My guest is Representative Paul Torkelson. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to him about the dynamics within the Republican Party, what he's seen and what he's hoping for. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO. We are back on Sunday Take.
For years, Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Through deeply reported, narrative-driven stories, we're digging into the myths, scandals, and power structures that still shape the South, and in a lot of ways, the country itself. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, an Odyssey podcast. Available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
My guest is Representative Paul Torkelson. He announced last week that he is not running again, and we're reflecting on his time in the legislature. Representative Torkelson, obviously Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party. We in Minnesota have seen a month or more of a certain amount of chaos in the cities, but also in greater Minnesota. Last week, I had Representative Dave Baker on, who talked about the impact of ICE actions in Willmar. What first, any immediate reactions on, you know, immigration action in Minnesota? Any sense on what you are seeing in your community?
Well, I would say, number one, going out and arresting and deporting criminals, genuine criminals, you know, that have committed felonies and above is welcomed, I think, especially in greater Minnesota, but probably throughout the state. What's not so welcome is this is the way they've been doing business and the fact that we have had this kind of wink, wink, nod, nod immigration system in place for a long time where we don't really, we're kind of in the cloudy world between legal and illegal. And it's a shame that we haven't straightened that out and put an immigration system in place that really honors and respects the people that many of us depend on for a variety of jobs that they fill within our economy. There's room for lots of improvement, but right now it feels like there's been open warfare between the president and the governor. And that is certainly not helping.
When you think about the issues that you first ran on and the issues that Republicans are focused on now, or maybe feel different or louder, are there ways within either within your caucus or amongst your colleagues that you've found a way to bridge the gap? Or has the Republican message not changed that much and it just is louder and maybe a little more polarized in Minnesota?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I don't think our, you know, we're still kind of the small government, lower taxes, run government efficiently kind of party that social issues have, I think were probably in many ways bigger when I was first elected. We've made some progress there, but I think what's changed is really driven by the polarization. And I think that's driven by the fact that many people get stuck in the echo chamber. They go online and go through social media. They listen to the people that agree with them. And that agreement just kind of echoes back and forth. And you get this dramatically diverse opinions with among people that really aren't that different from each other, but they've developed these really diverse political opinions. And I think a lot of it is to blame on social media.
How does that come out when you meet somebody or when you're talking about an issue? Do they reference it? Or I kind of want to know that view from the elected official, because I will tell you, in my role, I get a lot of, I saw it here, or I saw it there. And, often I have to find a way to correct or clarify something with a listener or a reader, or offer, two views and say, here's two views, look at both of them and then decide. Does it come up when you meet newer members, younger members? Are they more kind of in tune with that social side?
Yeah, well, it really depends on the issue. Many issues that don't get so politicized, we still have our normal discussions about, and people exchange ideas and opinions. But some of these issues that have gotten highly politicized are really hard to talk about with some people that have developed this attitude or belief in things that are just on the edge of truthfulness or beyond the edge of truthfulness in some cases. And it really makes it difficult to have a conversation.
As we wrap here, you've now also had the unique role of being in a tied house. You're part of leadership there. What did the tie kind of create? What has it taught you? And what lesson would you say?
Well, the big change. Yeah,
go ahead.
The big change, I think, was the fact that nothing could come out of our committee without bipartisan support. So that forced negotiations that otherwise wouldn't probably happen at a higher level down to the committee level. And I think in many ways that was healthy and helpful, because the members of committees were forced to kind of have a good exchange about what might pass in legislation. But it was to some degree a new experiment. We've never done it before. And I think we did it pretty well. I worked very hard with Zach Stevenson, my co-chair, last year to get targets out on time. We met many, many times, many, many hours to get those targets out. And I was actually pretty proud of our work. I didn't get everything I wanted. He certainly didn't get everything he wanted. But we got the job done, and that kind of set the stage for getting the session finished. We could have so easily ended up going to a shutdown.
Knowing both of you and knowing that there is a certain public, but there's also a roll up your sleeves attitude. He's now the DFL leader. You've obviously been very critical, not critical in a bad way, but you've been a key player in the Republican leadership. How do you think this upcoming session will go? You're still going to need bipartisan votes. What are the key issues that you think there might be some unity on to try to, bring forward in this next session?
Well, I've been working really hard on getting the software that counties use upgraded. I think it's a key to running our social programs efficiently, effectively, and in a secure fashion. County workers are using these green screen programs from the 90s that shut down regularly and don't allow them to do their job well. And I think that's driven some of the issues we've had with the social programs, where they're just not well run. That's something that's just kind of a personal crusade of mine that I'm going to try and pursue. We did a lot of work on that last year. I want to build on that work this year. Of course, the bonding bill will be a topic of conversation. If we're going to do a bonding bill, we have to find the money to do it, because there's not money built into the budget right now. Money's tight. We're all looking ahead to this looming deficit in the next biennium. So there's not going to be a lot of spending. I would guess to fund a bonding bill, we're going to have to find some savings somewhere else. And I think that potential does exist. I think there's some unspent funds from past allocations that we may be able to claw back and actually fund some of the things that we probably should do this term without putting ourselves deeper in the deficit hole.
Representative Paul Torkelson, I know we'll see each other this session. I know you have a year of work left, and I know you'll roll up your sleeves and get it done. Thanks for always being available and sharing. And also, we'll see you in a couple of weeks when session starts.
Well, thanks, Boyce, and thanks for the work you do to inform the citizens of Minnesota, kind of I think you got a pretty realistic approach on what goes on at the legislature. I appreciate that. Some people like to throw gas on the fire, and that's not helpful. And you don't do that, and I appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Representative. When we come back, this week's take. Welcome back to Sunday Take. Before we get to the take this week, I want to call out one of the more challenging parts of this whole situation we're in with the federal government, and that's the court situation. There is a clear legal strategy here by Attorney General Ellison and others that is really fueling what they believe is a legal pushback. And as you think about all of the scenarios that have been out there, it begins to be clear that there's more to this than just a negotiation, ICE and the Border Patrol changing their tactics. But the legal case is to set precedent. And there are multiple cases, multiple strategies that go with this strategy. And earlier this week in the Morning Take, we lined these up. And what are the cases that are, you know, really out there? And so I want to just let yesterday, the 5-year-old boy and his father were ordered released in Texas. They were a part of what's called a habeas case. And the habeas cases are people who were in the legal process of becoming citizens that ICE and the Border Patrol picked up and quickly detained and tried to deport. One of the tactics that we know about is that they would detain somebody, but they didn't have a lot of space at Whipple, so they would immediately fly them to Texas. And then in Texas, they would be held for their case to be heard. And then the judges in Texas and the judges in Minnesota would have to make sure that this got all aligned. Well, I just say that some of those cases are the things to watch, I think, for the medium and long term. Some Democrats have thought that those would make things different faster. But on Saturday, the one case from the two cities and the attorney general that would have put a stop or a restraining order on ICE activities in Minnesota, Catherine Melendez, the judge, ruled against the state and the cities. So we have the habeas cases, and then we also have the injunction case, and in those two cases. But most lawyers I talk to say, well, watch and see how that plays out. You put that in parallel with what's happening in Congress, the freezing the DHS funding, 7 Republicans pushing back against the president, and it's going to bring more of the pressure on the federal government as they have these operations in other places. I think the real sad and troubling and disturbing part is that, again, this all happened in Minnesota. And was there a different way? Was there a better way? And you look at ICE's actions in places like Illinois and Chicago earlier this year, and they were disruptive, but they were not disastrous like they were in Minnesota with the 2 deaths, another shooting, and the chaos that has ensued. And so watch those court cases to see if that is ultimately what changes ICE's behavior. Because it is the legal nuts and bolts that are going to get a solution here. There's been a lot of rhetoric. And in that rhetoric, they're losing sight of how government is working together. For instance, in Minneapolis, which is in Hennepin County, you have a situation where the city turns over any crime or any person to Hennepin County, and then Hennepin County prosecutes them. And, you know, we've talked about Mary Moriarty on this show before, but that's where there's a disconnect with the way in which the prosecutor, county attorney, deals with the jail, deals with criminals who may not be here legally. And hopefully that can all get fixed up. Hopefully we can help that smooth over and we can go from there. The other thing I want to call out in this last week is Tom Homan's arrival, how the tone changed, how it looks like he actually wants to solve this problem and not amplify it or fuel it further. And this is really one of the things that I am going to not let up on. Governors, presidents have to appoint good people. And it is very clear that Greg Bovino and Kristi Noem had a different idea of what this was supposed to be. The dishonesty, the distrust that they have fueled in their words and their tactics is something that it's going to take Minnesota and probably the country a long time to correct from. And that brings me to this week's take. This week's take is about the situation Minnesota is in. This is not a Minnesota issue. This is a national issue. And it is an issue for Republicans. If you really think about this, as we start a new month, the second month, 2 days before caucuses, Republicans, I think, know, they certainly know at the legislative level and at the grassroots level, that this has become a major problem for Republicans. And I say this because the poll that KSTP put out on Friday begins to show how unpopular President Trump has become. Now, I'm here to tell you that President Trump in a midterm was going to be unpopular. And it was just a month ago that that was going to be countered in Minnesota by the fraud issues, which are still going to be an issue. But let's look at the approval ratings. Tim Walz disapproved 51%, underwater. That aligns with two or three private polls that we've taken for various clients over the last month. Tim Walz approval rating, 45%. Donald Trump disapprove in Minnesota, 59%. His approval, only 39%. So he's 11 points. And this says that Republicans in Minnesota, if they want a chance this fall, they're going to have to find a new brand. And they're going to have to find it fast. And it can't be like Coke to New Coke because it's still not as good as the original brand. And they need part of the original brand of Trump to keep Republicans energized. I know you might find that hard to believe, but the reality is that Donald Trump is still the top of the party. The other part of that poll was that 61% of Minnesotans disapprove of Trump's handling of immigration enforcement. 38% approve. Again, way underwater for what Minnesota has been exposed to for the last 2 months. And in a vivid, horrific, trauma-causing way for the last month. So think of it this way. Donald Trump, the poll numbers say, and the images will tell you, Donald Trump's action, his administration's action, has caused trauma on voters of Minnesota at a level that Republicans are going to have a hard time getting out. 64% of Minnesotans disagree with immigration strategies used by ICE. Again, 64%. So Republicans have to eat back like 15%. Of the disapproval that has been caused in 1 month. If that's a sports score, that's a miracle of a comeback. If that's a sports score, that's a landslide. And in a state where Republicans in midterms have had enough trouble juicing turnout, getting energy, they're going to have a really hard time getting energy if 64% of Minnesotans disapprove of the way that your president and ICE handled the last month. Republicans are playing from further behind in Minnesota than maybe they ever have. Now, the one factor is that 50% of Minnesotans believe that state and local authorities should help with immigration enforcement. And it is very clear that Governor Walz, Jacob Frey, and many others have not done anything to help with immigration enforcement. They'll argue that it's not the locals' job to enforce federal law. But that's what comes to governing. That's what comes to the independents thinking, let's work together. Let's figure this out. Let's not continue down this corridor of chaos that we have been involved with. So the take is that unless Republicans in Minnesota find a different way to communicate and separate themselves from President Trump this fall, it could be another disaster. It could be a disaster that just a month ago they did not imagine. Now, fraud is still going to be a major issue, and the economy of Minnesota is going to be a major issue. But Amy Klobuchar has the potential to have coattails in places that Republicans have been nominating, like the Iron Range. And suburban independents in blue districts like Woodbury, Stillwater, Chaska, Chanhassen, Blaine, Maple Grove, Lakeville, are going to be running into a headwind that they have never seen. So imagine you're a Republican state senator, a Republican state representative, and you're at a door and you're door knocking. And the question is, what about President Trump? What about his ICE actions? How do you align with that party? And the candidate will try to flip it to fraud or education or schools. But the feelings evoked by this immigration enforcement and how wrong it has felt and looked and been in an America that never, ever expected that, never anticipated it. And our eyes don't lie. So it might only be February 1st, but there's a straw poll on February 3rd, and there's a lot of Republicans running in that race. Some of them say they'll go to a primary. And in that primary, they'll have to decide, where do they stand with President Trump? But the reality is, President Trump isn't president for more than this term. Of course, he may try, he may act like he is, but Minnesota is going to lead a trend that could leech over into 2028, that could make MAGA a memory. Or such a minority party in the suburbs and in the cities that red states and red counties will be then further out there on the political spectrum. Competition is good. Leadership is better. And ultimately, somebody in Minnesota and the Republican Party is going to have to lead out of this darkness, find a different message, find a different tone, and probably run against President Trump, at least in the issues and the message. Elliot Engen, a state rep, did that a couple years ago. Now he's running for statewide office. He's hoping for a party endorsement. He's a provocateur. He's young. But it's going to take somebody who can really stand out. Maybe even a woman in the Republican Party to say, we can't do this anymore. And the take is, until the Republicans in Minnesota show momentum towards something else, they're playing from 10 to 14 points behind this year, when just a month ago, they were playing either even or 1 or 2 points ahead in the governor's race. I'm Blaise Olson. I'll be with Vanita at 6:20 Monday through Thursday. You can always follow along at thedailyagenda.com. Corzo's up next. We lost two GMs this week in the Vikings and the Twins. We got Miracle documentary to watch. And it's going to be warmer this week. Warm up your hearts. Have a good week. Talk to you next week. That's The Take.
I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.